Well, today I'd like to start into a lengthy series on money and wealth. It's been almost 10 years since I preached on the topic of money management. It would have been 10 years this summer ago. And I've mentioned things here and there in the last 10 years, and I've ranted about various things, my soapboxes regarding this topic. But I haven't really covered it in much detail, and this time around I want to cover it in a lot of detail. The Bible has a ton to say about money and wealth, so this is intended to be an exhaustive treatment on the subject. Now, some of you may not look forward to this. I don't know. Maybe none of you look forward to it. But the way I look at it is, it's good either way, because if you want to hear it, then that's good, because I like preaching to people who want to hear what I have to talk about. And if you don't want to hear it, that's good too, because that means you need to hear it. And I like preaching to people who need to hear what I have to say also. So either way, this is going to be a good series, Lord willing, God being my helper. I do have 2.5 pages of outline this morning, and that's just the table of contents. So like I said, big study. I do want to look at just a few of the things that we're going to cover. I'm not going to go through the entire table of contents. That would probably take me a sermon in and of itself. But I just want to hit the major points in the table of contents so you have an idea of what I'm going to cover over the next few months. We want to look at how a person uses money will tell us a lot about him. And we're going to look at that this morning. And just some observations that I had that you can just look at how people do things with money and you can derive information about that person. We're going to look at what money is. I think a lot of people carry it around with them. They use it every day. But if you actually ask the person what is money, he might have a hard time explaining to you what money actually is. And I don't mean necessarily real money. I just mean money in general. But real money, most people don't know anything about that. So we'll talk about that a bit. I want to talk about how money is not evil. And I may get to that today, or that might have to wait until next Sunday. But that's an idea that some people, a lot of probably mainly Christian people have, and some far left woke people as well. But there are Christians out there that believe that essentially money's evil, and it's wrong to even talk about money, to think about money, to let money be of any importance in your life at all, because we should be concerned with the higher spiritual things. But that's a bunch of bunk. That's nonsense. And I'm going to thoroughly disprove that idea. I want to look at whether or not money buys happiness. And the answer may surprise you, because everybody says money doesn't buy happiness. And there's a lot of truth to that, but it's also nuanced. Money does buy happiness sometimes. Just go down and live in Louisiana in the middle of the summer with no air conditioning and then see if $100 a month might buy you happiness. If you had air conditioning, it would definitely make you happier. I guarantee you. But it doesn't ultimately buy happiness, of course. We're going to look at how to acquire money and wealth. And I want to go through this mostly in a logical fashion. So the order in which I cover things is sort of the order that they ought to happen. In order to have any money, of course, you have to acquire it, first of all. And we'll talk about how you acquire money legitimately, like working, being an employer, an employee, or so on. And there's other ways, of course, and we'll look at those inferior ways, like inheritance, lottery, begging, theft, things like that. There's other ways of acquiring wealth, but not a good idea. Then we're going to look at saving. And I'll have a lot to say about saving, various things about that, how, when, and how much, and why, and all those kind of things. Then we'll look at investing. And did you know that investing is actually biblical? The Bible talks about investing. It doesn't use that word, but it uses another word, which is a synonym of it. So we're going to look at investing, how you can make your money work for you. We'll look at some technical stuff, like different retirement type accounts that are tax advantageous and things like that. We're going to look at budgeting, which I guess I probably should have put budgeting before saving, because that's kind of how you save money, is by budgeting. But so that would be a little out of order possibly, but we're going to talk about budgeting and how important that is. We're going to look at giving and show how that's a vital part of doing well with money is giving, giving to God, giving to the poor, just giving, being generous to other people in general. Then we're going to look at spending. That's certainly a part of money. We're going to look at this. It's going to be an interesting thing. I said I wouldn't cover everything, but this one just jumped out at me. We're going to look at one major reason why Americans, most Americans, are broke. And when I say broke, and I'll be using this term a lot throughout the study, when I say people are broke, I don't mean somebody that works part-time at McDonald's and makes like not enough money to even, you know, have enough food. I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about a guy that's going through a bankruptcy right now. I'm talking about the average American, which lives paycheck to paycheck, who has very little money saved, definitely no full 3 to 6 month emergency fund, that if he lost his job for more than a paycheck or a month, he'd be totally screwed, right? Which is like almost everybody. So that's what I say when I mean broke. Why most Americans are broke comes down to one very significant thing: vehicles. Vehicles. And I will show you the math, and I will show you why most people are broke. And it's that one thing: vehicles. Specifically new vehicles, but vehicles in general, but new vehicles are the real one that will keep people in bond servitude, in debt slavery their entire lives. We're going to look at lending. Now, I don't mean banks lending to you. I mean you lending to other people. So that's what happens after you start making some money, start saving some money, start acquiring some wealth. Then you're in a position, instead of borrowing, you're in a position to lend. And we'll talk about when that is wise to do and when it's not wise to do. And most of the time, it's actually not wise to do. It's not a good idea to lend people money, usually, because you'll just end up enabling them, ruining them, continuing their debt servitude and bond servitude. And so not a good idea in many cases. But we'll talk about when it's okay. And we'll also talk about lending with interest, when it's okay to lend people money on interest, when it's not, things like that. The Bible talks about that topic quite a bit. Now we're going to talk about taxes. That's a big part of money, unfortunately. We're going to talk about debt. That's definitely going to be a big theme in this study, debt. We're going to talk about reasons to avoid it, like the plague. We're going to talk about how it's foolish to be in debt. We're going to talk about the broke person mindset versus the wealthy person mindset. And that's what it really comes down to. If you're ever going to build wealth, if you're ever going to get ahead in life, it's going to come down to your mindset. Do you have a broke person mindset, which is what 95% of all Americans have, or do you have a wealthy person mindset? That's going to determine how your life goes. I'm going to talk about the build your credit myth. You know, this is like the biggest myth out there. Build your credit. You got to get a credit card. You got to build your credit. You got to take out a car loan. You got to build your credit. You know, bunch of bunk nonsense. It's funny. Dave Ramsey is a like multi uber millionaire. The guy has zero credit score. He has no credit history, period. He looked up his own credit and it just came back and it said no information. Like he literally has no credit score. He doesn't need one. He doesn't ever borrow money for anything. Your credit score is worthless if you're doing your money right. Don't worry about your credit score. If you're doing your money right, your credit score will be fine. But your credit score is immaterial. It doesn't matter if you're doing it right. We're going to talk about how not to buy or build a house until you're financially prepared to do so. And I don't mean financially prepared is I have a paycheck now, and now I can go take out a big fat mortgage and, you know, be a debt slave for 30 years. That's not when you're financially prepared. Like, there's a lot more to being financially prepared other than that. We're going to talk about how Christians should be lenders and not borrowers. We're going to talk about how being a debtor is to be cursed and under the judgment of God according to the scripture. We're going to talk about avoiding and hating debt, paying your debts, contentment, the keeping up with the Joneses thing. Don't ever try to keep up with the Joneses because the Joneses are broke. Don't ever keep up with the Joneses. They're broke. They have the illusion of wealth. They don't have any. We'll talk about covetousness, which is the driving force behind being in debt. And we'll talk about how to get out of debt. Then we'll look at gambling, because again, just anything that has to do with money and like virtually your entire life and everything you do and every decision you make has to do with money. So this sermon could get really, really, really long. But anything that I could think of that has to do with money in the Bible, I wanted to cover. So gambling, and the Bible does have a little bit to say about that. Bankruptcy, the Bible actually has something to say about that too, actually. Being surety, which is being a co-signer, which is being interpreted the dumbest thing you could possibly do in your entire life. Don't ever do that for anybody, for any reason. Horrible idea. Not for your kids, not for anybody, not for anything, ever. We're going to look at insurance and how some insurance is necessary. It's a good thing. Some insurance should be avoided like the plague. It's a terrible financial instrument that will not get you ahead at all, like whole life insurance and things like that. Being rich, so we're going to look at that, and we're going to look at being poor, and there's nothing wrong with either one if done right. If you're rich and you've done it right and the Lord's blessed you with it and you've been wise, nothing wrong with being rich. And if you're poor because the Lord has chosen poverty for you and it's not due to your own stupid decisions, there's nothing wrong with being poor either. We're going to talk about retirement. Leaving an inheritance. So you kind of see how we go, like, sort of from the beginning down to the, you know, to the very end. And then finally you die and you get to leave your wealth to other people, which is not a bad thing. It's called generational wealth. If you do it right, you can change your family tree. You can change your family tree and make a huge difference in the lives of your posterity, which, of course, requires teaching them these things. The last thing you want to do is leave an inheritance, a monetary inheritance, to your children without teaching them how to manage money. That's a stupid thing to do. It's not going to benefit them any, and you just wasted a whole life of saving and frugality and wisdom to give it to some fool who's going to blow it all. Then we're going to look at Pastor Wagner's practical tips on money management. And I have some of my rules. And of course, my rules don't have to be kept, but they've worked well for me anyway. So we'll look at some of those things, like don't finance anything with the possibility of with the possible exception of your first home. Never finance a thing except for that, if you have to. Pay for things with physical cash, not credit. If you use a credit card, pay it off daily. Get out of debt as quickly as possible. Create a budget and make it automatic. That one's a really important one. We'll talk about how taking out a 30-year mortgage to write off the interest on your taxes is stupid. And any CPA that tells you, oh, it's a good thing to have a 30-year mortgage because you can write off the interest you pay on your taxes, that guy is an idiot who apparently didn't even go to first grade to learn basic arithmetic. That is the dumbest idea ever. You never spend a dollar to save a quarter. I'll explain what I'm talking about. To take a 30-year mortgage and to write the interest off your taxes is spending a dollar to save a quarter. Now, if you want to do that, fine and dandy, I will go into business with you all day long. You give me as many dollars as you want, and I will give you as many quarters. We can do this all day long. You give me 100 grand, I'll give you 25 grand, and we can just continue to do this repeatedly for your entire life. I'd love to be in business with you if you want to do that. And then we're going to look at Dave Ramsey's 7 baby steps at how to get out of debt and to become wealthy. And that is save up $1,000 fast. This is for people who are, the beginning steps are for people who are in big trouble and debt up to their eyeballs. Save up $1,000 fast. Step 2, start the debt snowball, pay those things off. We'll talk about how to do that quickly. Step 3, finish your fully funded emergency fund, 3 to 6 months of living expenses. Step 4, invest 15% of your household income in retirement. Step 5, this is an optional one, in my opinion. I personally, not my thing, but save for college for your children. Maybe in limited situations, but that's one area that I probably would disagree with him on. And then pay off your home mortgage early, and that is a 15-year fixed rate mortgage only. And then build wealth and give like no other. Step number 7. And then I will sum up by a little exhortation about forgetting about being normal, because normal is broke. Normal in the United States is broke. You don't want to be normal. And then I will conclude with my hope and with an encouragement that it's never too late to start. Doesn't matter how old you are or how young you are. Because young people think they have the rest of their lives, and if they would start young, they could be very wealthy and very well off and be a huge blessing to many people around them, to family, friends, church, community. It could be a huge blessing if they started young and did these things. And it's never too late to start when you're old. I mean, you're not going to get as far ahead, but no time like the present. Now, before I do get into the rest of the outline here, I named the sermon Money and Wealth. And these things are not the same thing. And specifically, income and wealth are not the same thing. This is where people get so mixed up. They confuse income and wealth. They look at people that have large incomes and assume they're wealthy. And I'll tell you a little secret. Most people that have large incomes are not wealthy. They have negative net worth. When you take their assets and subtract their liabilities, their debts, in other words, they have negative net worth. The people that you think are wealthy are not wealthy, for the most part. Occasionally, there is somebody that actually looks wealthy that is, but most people that look wealthy aren't. Most people that are actually wealthy don't look wealthy. And you know why they don't look wealthy? Because if they looked wealthy, they wouldn't be wealthy, because they'd have blown all their money on dumb stuff. And if you think that I'm harsh in my delivery, you ought to listen to Dave Ramsey sometime. He's even more so. I'm reading this book called The Millionaire Next Door. I just got this thing. I actually just got it yesterday. And Ramsey talked about it in one of his books. I will recommend you Ramsey's books. Don't read this one first, though. I will recommend you three books. This is one of them. But get Ramsey's book, The Total Money Makeover. Get that one first. And then his book called Dave Ramsey's Complete Guide to Money. Get that one second. And then this one third. But anyway, this the guy that wrote this, there's two men. Thomas Stanley was the main one. He did scientific research. This is back in the 80s. He wrote this book in the mid-90s. And he did scientific research to understand the wealthy and to try to learn how to market to the wealthy, I think is what he was originally trying to do. And he started doing, he did all these interviews with millionaires. And he wanted to find out, like, why do some people become millionaires? Why do some people become wealthy and most people don't? What is the reason for this? And so when he started out his study, he did what probably all of us would think if we didn't know better. And he went to the affluent, upscale neighborhoods, right? He'd go to, like, Overland Park or whatever, whatever the fancy neighborhood down in Overland Park is. He'd go there and think, well, here is where the millionaires live. I want to find out how they got wealthy. And he found out something really interesting, that virtually none of the people in the upscale neighborhoods are wealthy. They don't have any money. They got big incomes, but it all just goes out as fast as it comes in. They don't actually have any wealth. And he thought this was fascinating. Like, how is it that all these people that look like they're wealthy, that would be millionaires, they're broke? And then he found out something even more interesting. When he actually found the millionaires, and he started to interview, and he interviewed thousands of millionaires. When he found the millionaires, he found out that they're the people just living in a normal neighborhood. Your neighbor that you'd never have any idea is a millionaire. Those are the millionaires. They're the people that drive, you know, the cars that are maybe 2-3 years old, just regular Ford American car. They don't drive the fancy cars. They don't drive the luxury cars. They don't drive new cars. Hardly any millionaire buys a new car. Hardly any millionaire does. That's why they're millionaires. So anyway, it was very interesting. And he had this to say here. I thought this was worth sharing. I just read it last night, so it's not in the outline, but there will probably be some stuff from this book in the outline later. He said, this is on page one of the introduction. He said, most people have it all wrong about wealth in America. Wealth is not the same as income. If you make a good income each year and spend it all, you are not getting wealthier. You're just living high. Wealth is what you accumulate, not what you spend. How do you become wealthy? Here, too, most people have it wrong. It is seldom luck or inheritance or advanced degrees or even intelligence that enables people to amass fortunes. See, that's where people think that the wealthy become wealthy. You know, they inherited it, or they're just super smart, or whatever. No, not true. Wealth is more often the result of a lifestyle of hard work, perseverance, planning, and most of all, self-discipline. And that's what it comes down to, self-discipline. People that get wealthy are self-disciplined people. And if you are not self-disciplined, you will never become wealthy or even close to it, ever. So one of the things that I want you to learn from this series, if there's a takeaway, there would be a lot of them, but one takeaway that I want you to take away from this series is to stop looking at broke people and assuming that they're wealthy. We all do that. We all have that temptation. We see a guy driving a brand new Mercedes and we think, man, that guy is wealthy. Stop that. That guy is broke. In 99 out of 100 times, that guy is broke. You see the guy driving the big old F-250 brand new fancy truck with the trailer and the side-by-side on the back, you think, man, must be nice to be that guy. He's wealthy. He's got money. He's broke. He's broke. He's got nothing. Guaranteed it. 99, 95 out of 100 times, he's broke. Quit looking at broke people and thinking they're wealthy. Because what that makes you think is that I can do that too. Why can't I do that? Well, because you're going to be broke like he is if you do that. Stop looking at broke people and thinking they're wealthy. See, I've trained myself over the years to do the opposite. I look at people who appear to be wealthy and assume that they're broke. And 95% of the time I'm right because they are. There is the occasional time I'm wrong. But the guy at the red light beside you, he's broke. Guarantee it. The guy in the upscale neighborhood, he's broke. Just start thinking like that. They're broke. If they lost their income for a month, they'd be screwed. And then they'd be taking out a second mortgage, a home equity loan to try to make ends meet for, you know, until they can get another job. They're broke. Every once in a while, I'm wrong. I have an acquaintance that I've gotten to know. And before I got to know him, I saw him driving around in a Mercedes. My automatic thought was, oh man, he's broke, dead up to his eyeballs. I was wrong about him. I didn't realize that the Mercedes is 10 years old. It looks new, but it's 10 years old, for one thing, so it doesn't cost a whole lot. He pays cash for all his cars. He's a big follower of Dave Ramsey. He's not broke at all. But, you know, 95 out of 100 times the dude driving a Mercedes is broke. But in that case, this guy wasn't. And that's the thing. If you want people to think you're wealthy, just drive a 10-year-old nice-looking car, and everybody's going to think you're loaded, and you paid way less for it than they paid for their mediocre, average new car that they just spent a fortune on. You paid about a third for your really fancy-looking car, and then people think you're wealthy if you're into that. But personally, I don't want people to think I'm wealthy, even if I was. So millionaires don't care what other people think. That's another one of my favorite quotes from Dave Ramsey. Who cares what broke people think? You got to get that through your head. Who cares what broke people think? You start doing things that you're going to learn in this series, and you start being wise with money, and your family and your friends and your coworkers and all your people that you know, they're all going to think you're crazy. But who cares what broke people think? Why would you care what they think? All right. Finally, let's get to the introductory comments. Money is as much a part of life as is any other thing. If you think about it, why would I do a sermon, a lengthy sermon on money? Well, it's because money is probably more intertwined in life than any other thing. Money touches on everything. Just do a little thought experiment when you go home and just try to think of something in your life that does not have to do with money. Boy, I really like Diet Cokes. Can you buy one without money? I like to go out to a coffee shop. Can you do that without money? I like Fords versus Chevys. Can you do that without money? Right? Whatever, anything you like. I like to spend time with my family and have them over for dinner. Can you do that without money? Literally every single thing you do in your life, with very few exceptions, is tied to money. Money has to do with everything. It's not the most important thing in the world, but it's absolutely indispensable. You literally can't live without it. I mean, not unless you're in some barter economy or something like that. But, you know, in a modern economy, you obviously can't live without money. The Bible says that money answers all things. Ecclesiastes 10 and verse 19. Don't confuse what I'm saying. I'm not saying it's the most important thing. I'm just saying, if you don't get money right, the rest of your life is going to be messed up. You got to get money right, or it's going to mess up the rest of your life, because it touches on everything. Ecclesiastes 10 and verse 19. It says, a feast is made for laughter, and wine maketh merry, but money answereth all things. Money answereth all things. Money can't solve all your problems, but it can solve a lot of them. It's not going to solve all your problems. I mean, there are certain, you know, emotional, psychological problems, love problems, right? There's going to be some problems that money can't solve, obviously. But money can solve a lot of problems. And as I've said before, and I learned it from somebody else, if you can write out a check to solve a problem, it's not a problem. Think about that. If you can write out a check to solve a problem, it's not a problem. Now, things like that happen to most people, and it's a huge problem. For most people, if your car motor blows up, that's a big problem. But if you can write out a check, it's not a problem at all. It is a very minor inconvenience. If you can write out a check to the tow truck to have it towed to the mechanic, you can write out a check to the mechanic to have a new motor put in it, you can write out a check to the car rental place to rent a car for a week or two while it gets done. Very minor inconvenience. But if you've got no money, no emergency fund, no car fund set up, and your motor blows up, it is an unmitigated catastrophe, which could ruin your entire life. Like, you literally could go into bankruptcy if you've maxed yourself out on credit cards and home equity loans and all this stuff. Like, it's a huge problem. So for somebody who's broke and hasn't managed their money well, a blown motor is the end of the world. For somebody who's managed their money well, it is a minor inconvenience. It's just a matter of signing your name on a check. Not a big deal. Managing money well will also prevent many problems from arising in your life. If you manage your money well in the first place, you'd be surprised at all the problems in your life that don't come. When you don't manage your money well, all of a sudden all these problems come, and like every little thing is a crisis. I got a flat tire. It's a crisis, right? Any little thing happened. I broke my leg. It's a crisis, right? Everything's a crisis. Whereas, you know, if you've been wise with money, a lot of these crises just are no big deal. Not to say that your life's not going to be, you're not going to have trouble. You will. But at least you're not going to have trouble with things that you could write out a check to solve. Most decisions in life have to do with money in one way or another, like I said already. So therefore, the Bible has a lot to say about money and wealth, obviously, because it's so intertwined with our lives. Money can be a blessing or a curse, a help or a hindrance. Somebody said, I have this quote later on in the outline, and it was something to this effect, that money is a great servant and a terrible master. It's a great servant and a terrible master. If you control money, if you tell money where to go and what to do, it is a wonderful servant. If your lack of money, your debt, tells you where to go and what to do, it is a terrible master. If you manage money well, happiness and well-being will result. See, like I said, wise people tell their money what to do. Fools are told what to do by their debts. The Bible says the borrower is servant to the lender. You become a slave when you come into debt. And those debts control your life. You've got this big burden, this big ball and chain hanging on you, weighing you down, limiting where you can go, what you can do. It controls you. You need to learn to tell your money where to go, not to wonder where it went. That's another saying that I got from somebody else. Tell your money where to go, don't wonder where it went. Wise people tell their money where to go. Fools wonder where it went. If you manage money poorly, sorrow, stress, and misery will result. Now, let's look at how a person uses money will tell us a lot about him. I have a lot of Bible verses later on in this sermon. If I get to that point, I may not get to all of it. So anyway, I got some more things to say, and then we're going to get to the Bible. So how a person uses money will tell us a lot of things about him. For instance, a person who saves a significant amount of his income is wise. A person who spends all he makes and saves little or nothing is foolish. A person who saves all that he can and spends and gives nothing. Let me say that again. A person who saves all that he can and spends and gives little or nothing is miserly. You can learn something about that too. A person who gives liberally to God and his work on this earth is faithful and wise. A person who doesn't give to God and his work on this earth is unfaithful and foolish. A person who gives to others is generous and faithful. A person who never gives to others is stingy. You see how money and how a person deals with money, you can learn a lot about a person's character. A person who gets a raise, now you got to listen carefully to this one so you get it. A person who gets a raise and spends the same amount of money as before is wise. A person who gets a raise and spends the same amount of money as before is wise. That's what I call the millionaire mindset. Right there is the millionaire mindset. You want to become wealthy? That one little habit will make you wealthy. Every time you get a raise throughout your entire life, you spend the same amount, which means you save the rest. Now, virtually nobody does this. That's why everybody's broke. But if you do that, if every time you get a raise, you never change your spending, you're going to be wealthy. All things being equal. I mean, yeah, you could get cancer and be broke. You could, get some terrible calamity. The check for your home insurance could get lost in the post office and your house burns down the next week. And, anything could happen, right? But I'm saying all things being equal. A person who gets a raise and saves the same amount of money as before is foolish. That's what I call the broke man mindset. Let me give you numbers so I can make this plain for you. Let's say you make $4,000 a month. Okay, you make $4,000 a month. And you're a wise person. So let's say you're saving $1,000 a month. It'd be 25% of your income. That'd be a good amount of money to save. Really good amount of money. So you make $4,000 a month. You save $1,000 a month. Now this wise man, he gets a raise. He gets a promotion. And now he makes $5,000 a month. Now the wise man will continue to spend $3,000 a month, just like he did before. And he will save the additional $1,000. So now he'll save $2,000 a month instead of $1,000. He won't change his spending patterns at all when he gets the raise. He'll just live like he always lived. That's the millionaire mindset. That's the person who will build a lot of wealth. Now let's look at the other guy. The other guy, he makes $4,000 a month, just like the wise man. Only this guy's foolish. And, of course, he's not saving $1,000 a month. He's saving probably nothing, but we'll be generous to him. He's saving $100 a month, okay? So he makes $4,000 a month, and he saves $100 a month. And he gets a raise and makes $5,000 a month. What's he going to do? He's going to spend $4,900 a month. And he's going to save that $100 a month just like he was before. He's going to spend the extra $1,000 instead of save the extra $1,000. And that's why he's going to be broke the rest of his life. Because it doesn't matter. If you continually live on everything you make, you are going to be broke the rest of your life no matter how much you make. You could make $20,000 or $200,000. It doesn't matter. If you bring in $200,000 and you spend $200,000, you're just as broke as the guy that brings in $20,000 and spends $20,000. You're just as broke. And that's why most people are broke. Most people spend whatever they make. It's a fact. And everybody always tell you, if I just made an extra $1,000 a month, I mean, I would be set. I'd be fine. I wouldn't be in such financial problem if I just made $1,000 extra a month. And guess what happens when they make an extra $1,000 a month? In a month from now, they're going to say, if I just had an extra $1,000 a month, I'd be fine. And then they make an extra $1,000 a month. And you know what they say? If I just had an extra $1,000 a month, I'd be fine. Problem is not the income. The problem is the spending. I'm going to have a lot more to say about all this as we go through this. This is just the introductory comments. A person who gets an inheritance and spends it quickly is a fool. A person who gets an inheritance and saves most of it and spends a little of it is wise. A person who takes out a loan for something is discontent, impatient, immature, and foolish. A person who waits to buy something until he has saved up the money to pay cash for it is content, patient, mature, and wise. And Dave Ramsey made this point, and it just hit me like a ton of bricks. People that go into debt are immature. Because immature, somebody that's immature acts like a child, and children want things now. I want it now. I don't want to wait for it. Children don't want to wait for anything. They want it now. And when adults go into debt for things, they're acting like children. I want it now. I don't want to wait and save up for the car or for the house or for the whatever. I want it now. I'm going to take out an interest-only loan with nothing down because I want it now. Right? I want the new furniture now. I'm going to do the 90 days same as cash. I'm going to pay it off in 90 days. And of course you won't. And you'll pay it off over the course of years and you'll pay four times as much for that furniture as it's worth. I want it now. I'm going to swipe the card. I'm going to put it on my credit card because I want it now. Like that red-faced screaming kid in the store. Remember that the next time you act like that. You swipe the card. You sign your name on the loan. I want it now. That's what it is. It's immaturity. H. Jackson Brown Jr., in his one of my favorite books, The Complete Life's Little Instruction Book, number 663, said, "Remember that a person who is foolish with money is foolish in other ways too." And that one really made me think. And I thought, you know, there's a lot of truth in that. If you find a man who's foolish with money, start digging around in his life, and you'll probably find a man that's foolish in other areas too. Usually foolishness is not confined to one little area. Now, the way a person uses money will reveal his principles, or lack thereof. Dave Ramsey said in his book, The Total Money Makeover, I thought this was really good, he said, "The good thing about principles is that they make life easy. I have heard it said that when someone bases his life on principle, 99% of his decisions are already made." And that statement resonated with my soul. That is so true. I wholeheartedly agree with Mr. Ramsey. If you live your life on principle, if you have well thought out, biblically based principles, and you live your life by them, most of your decisions are already made. You don't really have to make a lot of difficult decisions because it's just not even an option. Having well thought out, biblically based principles, which one holds to firmly without wavering, makes life easier and greatly improves the quality of one's life. One of the many principles that I live by and have for my entire life is that I will never go into debt for anything, God being my helper. I will never go into debt for anything, and I mean anything. And that has, therefore, made my life's decisions, like most of them are just automatically, or a lot of them are just automatically made. Do I want to buy this fancy new car? Don't even go into the dealership. Don't even talk to the guy about it. Don't even think about it. Right? If I'm not going to write a check out for it, don't even think about it. And I'm not going to write a check out for some big, expensive, brand new car. Just the decision's already made. Should I buy this thing that I don't have the cash for and just put it on a credit card and pay it off later? No. I mean, the decision is already made. So I encourage you to be people that live by principle. Get those principles solid and down in your mind and just say, this is how I'm going to live my life and I don't care what anybody else thinks. This is what I'm doing, period. All right, now I told you we would finally get to the Bible. That took a little while. So let's talk about what money is. Like I said, you know, we all carry it around with us, or we used to anyway. I mean, I don't know if a lot of people don't carry money around anymore at all. They just carry plastic. But everybody has an idea. If you ask them what is money, they think, oh, it's those, you know, those green pieces of paper that we pass around. But probably most people haven't really thought about what money actually is. Money, by definition, here, Oxford English Dictionary, is current coin, metal stamped in pieces or of portable form as a medium of exchange and measure of value. Applied occasionally by extension to any objects or any material serving the same purposes as coin. In modern use, commonly applied indifferently to coin and to such promissory documents representing coin, especially government or banknotes, that's like your paper money, as are currently accepted as a medium of exchange. So money, if I could just define it simply in a sentence, money is a commonly used and accepted medium of exchange. That's what money is. You know, I suppose, I'm sure back in the Garden of Eden and after that, there was probably just a barter system where you had things somebody else wanted and you traded those things for other things. But of course, barter is extremely inefficient and no modern society could ever live on barter. I mean, you know, imagine if you're an orange farmer and all you have is oranges and you want some iron ore and you want some copper and you want some furniture and you want some clothes and the people that specialize in those things don't want any oranges. What do you do? Right? And you got to trade your oranges for something else and trade it to this guy. Obviously, it just, you know, it doesn't work. In very limited applications, you can barter things. You can trade somebody for something, but for the most part, you know, you can't run a society like that. That's why money quickly became a thing. You read about money, you know, way back in the beginning of the Bible. Items that function as money usually have the following characteristics. I said I was going to get to the Bible. I do have a verse here. I forgot. There's some more non-Bible stuff here. I promise you, I have a bunch of Bible that we'll get to here sometime. But anyway, let's just talk about money a little bit. Items that function as money usually have the following characteristics. They have intrinsic value, which means that they're valuable just in and of themselves. They have properties and characteristics that have inherent value in them, right? Gold and silver, I will mention later. Gold and silver for thousands of years have been money for these reasons. So as I mention these things, we'll just see how gold and silver fit the bill for these things. Paper money is technically money, but it's not a very good form of money. It has no intrinsic value. See, gold and silver has intrinsic value. It has properties that it's worth. It can be used for things, right? You can use gold and silver for things other than money. They have value in and of themselves. Paper money has, well, almost no intrinsic value. A $100 bill has maybe, what, a penny of intrinsic value? You could use it to write a note to somebody with it. You could use it to start a fire in your fireplace. You know, you could use it, if you didn't have any toilet paper, you could use it for that. Right? It has maybe a penny of intrinsic value, whatever a piece of paper is worth. But the, you know, it has basically no intrinsic value. It doesn't have $100 of intrinsic value. Durability. Gold and silver are durable. There was a guy just recently. He found a stash hidden in a field, kind of like the guy in Matthew 13. I don't know if he was digging for hid treasure or what, but he found a stash. He was probably metal detecting. You probably read the story. I think it was down to maybe Tennessee, Kentucky, somewhere. He found a stash of Civil War era gold coins that somebody had buried in a field. I think it was probably during the Civil War. Maybe it was he was afraid that the Yankees were coming to burn his house down or something and buried the gold in the field. It was a good idea, except he must have forgot about it or else he was killed by the Yankees or something. I don't know. Anyway, this guy found a big stash of gold coins just buried in the ground, and I'm sure they were just caked with dirt and all kinds of stuff right after 150 years. And guess what? He cleaned those things up, and they looked like brand new. Gold never tarnishes. It never corrodes. Nothing. It's durable, right? So that's why it's been good money, because it just, I mean, you take a gold coin that 2,000 years ago, and unless somebody's used it a lot and worn some of the gold off, other than that, I mean, it's just like it was 2,000 years ago. It's durable. Divisibility, right? You can take gold or silver, and you can divide it up into very small pieces. They're, you know, equally valuable, right? I mean, if cows are your money, cows are not a very good form of money. They're not very divisible. You can chop them up, right? But the tail is not worth as much as the prime rib cut or whatever, right? So not very divisible. Uniformity, which means they're all the same. You take a piece of gold and you stamp it, and it all looks the same. It's recognizable, right? It's got uniformity to it. Portability, you can carry a lot of value in a small package with gold and silver. You know, a little gold coin right now, an ounce of gold is worth $2,800. You know, so you can carry a lot of value in a little package. Limited supply. That's why they call them precious metals. They're limited. The gold supply, I think, only increases like 1-3% per year, something like that. All the easy stuff has already been found, right? The, you know, going panning for gold in the rivers and the creeks is long gone. You got to dig far down into the earth now to get it. It's limited supply. Acceptability, you know, people will accept it. They'll take it. You know, anybody will take it. And gold and silver have been like that. And non-counterfeitability. So it's pretty easy to counterfeit paper money if you have a good printer. And they come up with technologically ways, you know, that it's, makes it more difficult. But it's really hard to counterfeit gold and silver. I mean, people do it. They use tungsten and coat it and things like that. But, you know, that's pretty easy to figure out too. So because of these qualities, for thousands of years, people have used gold and silver as money. Let's just look at a little history of money. Historically, money consisted of precious metals such as gold and silver, and the value of the money was according to its weight. So let's turn to Jeremiah 32. Jeremiah 32, 9 through 10. This is how you used to determine how much money something was, or how much you're going to pay for something, is you'd weigh out the money, especially if it wasn't coined or something. If your gold was just in a, you had a bag of gold dust, or you had a bag of little nuggets or something like that, you went to buy something, you weighed out the money. And even if you had coins, you might weigh them out, because maybe the coins are, you know, they're not all perfectly uniform. Jeremiah 32, 9 through 10. And I bought the field of Hanamel, my uncle's son, that was in Anathoth, and weighed him the money, even 17 shekels of silver. And I subscribed the evidence and sealed it and took witnesses and weighed him the money in the balances. He weighed it to him. And did you know a shekel is a weight of money? Now, the word shekel ended up becoming a noun referring to a particular piece of money, but a shekel started out as a weight. And did you know, you might or you might not have, did you know that a dollar is the same thing? Did you know that a dollar is a weight of silver? Most people don't know that. You ask them, what is a dollar? And they pull out this green thing, you know, and say, this is a dollar. That's not a dollar. A dollar is a weight of silver. I will tell you exactly what that weight is here in a minute. It's a measure. A dollar is a measure. So when you say, you know, I'll give you a dollar for that, technically it's like saying, can you give me an inch? Well, an inch of what? Right? It's a measure. You say, give me a dollar. Well, it's a dollar of silver. And a dollar of silver is a specific weight of silver. Used to be, anyway. Shekel's an ancient unit of weight of the Babylonians, and hence of the Phoenicians, Hebrews, and others, equal to 1/60th of a mina. A coin of this type, especially the chief silver coin of the Hebrews. So it's a particular weight. So when Jeremiah wanted to buy the field, he actually weighed him the money. Now, can you imagine doing that today? If you wanted to buy something and they get out a weight and they say, okay, put your dollars on here. Well, I'm going to be paying with $1 bills and not $100 bills, I can tell you that much. If we're going to do it by weight, I'm going to give you a stack of $1 bills. They weigh a lot more than a $100 bill, don't they? Now, the dollar used to be a unit of weight, like I said, of gold or silver. This is from Peter Schiff's book, Crash Proof 2.0. He says, a dollar was first defined in the Mint Act of 1792 as 371.25 grains of fine silver, exactly the weight of the Spanish mill dollar, which was the most common coin in colonial America, and which continued to circulate legally in the United States until 1857. 70 years after the signing of the Constitution. So they based it on the old Spanish mill dollar, but that's what a dollar was. It was 371.25 grains of fine silver. The paper, the silver certificates, were just that, certificates. They represented the silver. You could trade them into the bank and get the silver. There was a certificate, right? Well, then they took the silver and they took the gold away and they just left you with the certificate. Now you just trade certificates, and you can't trade the certificates in for anything. That was quite the sly deal that they pulled on us there. The Constitution of the United States says, no state shall enter into any treaty, alliance, or confederation, grant letters of marque and reprisal, coin money, omit bills of credit, make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payments of debts. Now, apparently, somebody must have missed that part of the Constitution, because the states make these things, these dollars that we carry around in our pockets, and if you read on them, it says this is legal tender for all debts, public and private. But wait a minute, I thought it said that only gold and silver can be made tender for payments of debts. They just ignore that part of the Constitution. Well, I shouldn't say that part. They ignore the whole thing. But that's just part of it that they ignore. The United States was on a bimetallic standard, which means that they used both gold and silver for many years up until, well, I don't know how long they were on a bimetallic, but they used gold as money until, well, really until 1971. Roosevelt took it away in 34, which I'll talk about here in just a second. But anyway, the U.S. was on a bimetallic standard, which was problematic because the ratio of gold to silver would vary, and Gresham's law would cause the higher value metal to disappear from circulation. So let me just talk to you about a little geeky stuff here. There's a law, it's called Gresham's law, which basically says that bad money drives out good money. Okay, now you'd think, oh, the good money would drive out the bad money. No, it's the opposite. The bad money drives out the good money. And I'll give you a very simple example. In 1964, quarters were made out of silver, 90% silver. 1965, they took all the silver out, and now they're made out of, I don't know, some cheap metal. They're made out of nothing. It's not worth anything, a few pennies maybe. So, but they both look like quarters, right? They look the same almost, except if you look at the edge of them. They don't sound the same. You ever take an old quarter? I mean, it sounds, silver sounds different than you know, these cheaper metals. But anyway, when that happened, the bad money, the 65 and beyond money, the money without the silver in it, the bad money drove out the good money. How many 1964 quarters do you find in circulation today? Hardly any. I have found one occasionally. I've gotten one out of a machine. Anytime you get one, what do? Of course, you take it home, you stick it somewhere, and you don't spend it, right? The bad money drives out the good out of circulation. You'd be a total idiot today to walk into a grocery store or into a gas station with a handful of quarters and buy a gallon of gas or a bottle of pop or whatever. You'd be absolutely stupid because you just paid like $15 for something that's worth $3 or whatever. So anyway, that the bad money drives out the good. This is what happened to the U.S. They were on a gold and silver standard, and one was defined in terms of the other. And what would happen is if there would be an increase of supply of one of them, it would drive out the other one. So when the gold rush happened in California back in the 1840s, I think it was, 1850s, the increase of the gold supply went way up because everybody went out to California, they all started mining gold, and there got to be a lot more gold supply in the country. And so that was the lower valued money, because anytime the amount of something goes up, the value of it goes down, right? So gold was actually overvalued, silver was worth more, right? And what happened? It drove silver out of the market because people aren't going to spend the higher valued money. I'm going to spend the lower valued money, right? I'm going to spend I'm going to spend the junk quarters. I'm not going to spend the silver ones, right? Well, I'm going to spend the gold. I'm not going to spend the silver because it's, you know, the silver's worth more. And it drove silver out of circulation. You couldn't find silver anymore, right? So bimetallic standards, not a good idea. You should have them, them floating, not attached to another with a fixed ratio. But anyway, that's just the geek stuff. That doesn't matter. 1934, the U.S. government made it illegal for U.S. citizens to own gold. Roosevelt did that by executive order. That was a evil, wicked, rotten thing to do. It's called theft. And as soon as they did that, they revalued gold from $20 and some cents an ounce to $35 an ounce. They devalued gold by 70% as soon as they got everybody's gold. It's called inflation. That was wrong. They stole it all and then devalued it. 1965, silver was taken out of quarters and dimes. It was partly taken out of 50-cent pieces and then fully taken out of 50-cent pieces in the 70s sometime. 1971, the gold window was closed. Old Tricky Dick did that. Richard Nixon closed the gold window. Foreign governments were no longer able to redeem gold for dollars. It used to be, even after they stole all the gold from the people, foreign nations could still take their paper dollars and redeem them for gold up until 1971. Well, the government started spending way too much money. 1960s, they started the war in Vietnam, which is very costly. The space race, which is very costly. Johnson's war on poverty and all this stuff, very costly. Printing money like crazy. And foreign nations are starting to see, wait a minute, I mean, the U.S. is just printing this paper money up like crazy, and they don't have the gold to back it, and they want their gold. So they start trading in all their dollars for gold, because I want the real money, because, you know, this paper money is not going to be worth nearly as much. Well, all of a sudden, the U.S. is facing, Nixon's facing a crisis. We're going to be out of gold. Like, all of our gold's going to be gone. It's all going to be in foreign countries. And so he closes the gold window in 1971. At that point, the dollar became a purely fiat currency, which means backed by nothing. And without the gold backing, there's nothing left to restrain the Federal Reserve, which is our central bank, and they just printed as much paper money as they wanted, and you had the massive inflation of the 1970s. You had all the gas wars, the energy crisis, you had the and then, of course, the government steps in with wages and price controls. You older people might remember that, where they said you can't sell things beyond a certain price. And, of course, that creates shortages, and there's big long lines at the gas stations and all this stuff. This is what idiots do when they start to deflate your money or devalue your money, inflate it. And just look at a chart from 1971 until now, and look at what's happened to the value of the dollar, and just down, 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 and the dollar's now worth about 1% of what it was back in 1913 when the Federal Reserve was first created. They have stolen your money. They're doing it every day, every minute. They are stealing your money. It's just, imagine just some little criminal reaching into your bank account every single night and just taking a little bit of your money, a little bit of your money. Yeah, the same dollar amount's in there, but every day it buys a little bit less stuff, a little bit less stuff. They're just, every time they print money, every time they increase the money supply, dilutes that money supply, more money out there chasing the same amount of goods, prices go up, your savings goes down. They're robbing you. This wicked policy of debasing the currency is not new. The Jews were doing something sort of similar to it thousands of years ago. It says in Amos 8, 4 through 6, they were making the ephah small and the shekel great, falsifying the balances by deceit. Let's look at that in Amos 8, 4 through 6. Amos 8, 4 through 6. We're going to get past all this technical stuff here in the next sermon, so you're not going to have to worry. If this is boring to you, it's going to be over soon. Amos 8, 4 through 6. Hear this, O ye that swallow up the needy, even to make the poor of the land to fail, saying, when will the new moon be gone, that we may sell corn, and the Sabbath, that we may set forth wheat, making the ephah small, and the shekel great, and falsifying the balances by deceit, that we may buy the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of shoes, yea, and sell the refuse of the wheat, making the ephah small and the shekel great. Now, an ephah was a Hebrew dry measure, identical in capacity with the bath. It is variously said to have contained 4.5 to 9 gallons. So when they would put the stuff on the balance, and say you went to buy some wheat and you wanted to buy an ephah of wheat, well, they made the ephah small. So they had a container there, which would be, say, you know, 5 gallons. We'll just take, you know, a figure that's in between there, that those two numbers. We'll just say that an ephah was 5 gallons, like a 5-gallon bucket of wheat. Okay, so you want to get an ephah, a 5-gallon bucket of wheat. But this criminal here, he's got a bucket in the back, but it's only 4 gallons. It looks like, you know, he's changed it around a little bit, made it a little taller, a little narrower or something. He made it look like the 5-gallon bucket, but it's only actually 4 gallons. So he says, oh, you want an ephah of wheat? Okay. He fills you up 4 gallons of wheat and he sets it right there. Okay. He says, that'll be 10 shekels. He gets out his balance you get out your silver and you weigh out 10 shekels and he's got a 10 shekel weight on one side of the balance and you put on 10 shekels of silver on this other side of the balance. Only his 10 shekel weight is bigger. He's made the ephah great. He's got 12 shekels on this side. It says 10, but it's actually 12 shekels. So you put out 10 shekels on this side, and the scale's still like this. I mean, your side of the scale's still high, and you're like, well, I thought I put on 10. Keep putting on more. Now you put on 12. Now it balances out. You think, oh, my shekels must be mismarked or something. So now you paid 12 shekels for something you should have paid 10 shekels for. But not only that, you paid 12 shekels for 10 shekels worth of wheat, except you didn't get 10 shekels worth of wheat. You only got 4 gallons of wheat instead of 5 gallons. So you got less wheat for more money. Now, it's not exactly inflation per se, but it's the same effect. You just got less stuff for more money. The Jews had this figured out a long time ago. It's called fraud. God hates this kind of thing. Let's look at Proverbs 20 and verse 10. Proverbs 20 and verse 10. It says, divers, which means various. Divers weights and divers measures, both of them are alike abomination to the Lord. God hates divers measures and weights because of what they're doing with them. It's not that God hates a variety of weights, right? God doesn't care about a variety of weights. You know, you want to have a whole bunch of different weights. He doesn't care about that. What he cares about is when you set them on the scale and you pretend that one is the other. And you cheat somebody by using a different set of weights than they think you're using. It's an abomination to the Lord. Which means he hates it. Disgusts him. Let's look at Leviticus 19, 35 through 36. Leviticus 19, 35 through 36. The Lord says, ye shall do no unrighteousness in judgment, in meat yard, in weight, or in measure. So, length, weight, or measure, your volume. So, the three basic measurements there. Just balances, just weights, a just ephah, and a just hin shall ye have. I am the Lord your God, which brought you out of the land of Egypt. So the Lord did not want to see any cheating. The Lord takes that very seriously. The Lord wants to see even-handed dealings. See, but our modern-day Jews here, well, they're actually, most of them bankers are Jews, but anyway, the modern-day criminals that we have today, they do the same kind of thing, just differently. They do it through inflation. And inflation robs savers of their purchasing power. And it also creates the business cycle, which ultimately ends up in a bust, which destroys the jobs and lives of innocent people. I could get into the business cycle, but I probably have bored you enough already. But needless to say, the business cycle, when the Federal Reserve lowers interest rates, they create a demand for money. Money is cheap. When interest rates are low, it's like, you know, why do you refinance your house when interest rates go down? Because the money is cheaper, right? You can, your payments are less because the interest rate's lower. Well, when the interest rate goes lower, then people are more likely to invest. They're more likely to build things. They're more likely to take on big projects and build factories and things like that, right? Well, that's fine if the interest rates have been lowered by natural means, by people saving money, because the more people that save money, the lower the interest rate gets. The less people that save money, the higher the interest rate goes, because the bank wants to attract capital, so it raises interest rates to try to get you to put your money in the bank. Well, if there's a lot of people putting their money in the bank, a lot of people are saving, that naturally lowers interest rates, because the bank doesn't need to pay as much interest to try to attract the capital, right? So when, in that situation, on the free market, if a lot of people are saving money, and interest rates are then lower, then that gives a signal to entrepreneurs, this is a good time to expand. People are saving money. They're not consuming right now. I can build the factory. I can produce more stuff. And then people won't have the money that they're eventually going to use to buy the stuff, right? Well, when the Federal Reserve lowers the interest rate artificially, and they just say that it's going to be lowered, and there's no savings there to make it lower, what they signal to entrepreneurs is, this is a good time to expand. Money's cheap. So everybody starts expanding. Everybody starts hiring. Everybody starts building onto their factories, producing more stuff, more goods, more services. But the money's not there. The savings isn't there, right? It's just all, it's artificial. And then eventually, when they start building all the stuff, like just take housing for an example. The Federal Reserve kept interest rates really low back in the early 2000s. They dropped them down to 1%, blew up a big housing bubble. It was cheap to build houses. Builders start building a ton of houses, right? Well, what happens? Eventually, there's only a limited amount of resources in the economy. There's a limited number of trucks. There's a limited number of lumberjacks. There's a limited number of wood. There's a limited number of steel. There's a limited number of nails and workers. And there's limited numbers of everything, right? And all of a sudden, they start building all these houses. But there's not enough production in the actual economy to do this. There's not enough wood. There's not enough steel. There's not enough workers. There's not enough transportation. There's not enough stuff, right? So then they start bidding up the prices of everything because I need wood to build my house. I need wood to build my house. I need wood to build my house. And we all want this limited amount of wood. And guess what? We start bidding up the prices, right? So then wood becomes more expensive. Now all of a sudden, the house becomes a lot more expensive to build than we had originally planned on. And then what happens? I can't afford that. I can't afford to build all these houses that I've been trying to build. And then what happens? Now it goes bust. I can't finish the houses. I can't afford to finish the houses. I'm broke. I'm bankrupt. And then what happens? A big recession happens because we can't physically make all the stuff that we want to make. We've got false signals from the central bank, which has made interest rates really low artificially. And then the boom turns into a bust. And then you have the 2008 housing crisis, for instance. So that's just an example of the business cycle. I said I wouldn't explain it, and then I did. This is what inflation does. It robs you of your purchasing power. I have to try to not think about this because it infuriates me. If I think about the amount of money that I would have now versus what I have now versus what I would have had if interest rates for all those years would have just been normal, it infuriates me. The law of sevens. 7.2% in 10 years, your money doubles. You know, so it's a little less than that, but if interest rates would have been 5%, I don't know. You know, not that many years, your money doubles. Infuriates me. Not only did my money do nothing, the value of it went down, and it buys less and less stuff. We've been robbed, and it's wrong. But whatever. That's just life in this world. That's the judgment of God on a wicked nation, I suppose. All right, well, now enough talking about the government's mismanage of its money. Let's talk about yours next time, because we don't have time today. So anyway, I will get to all the verses that I told you I would get to earlier. We'll get to that next time, and we're going to talk about how money is not evil. It's not wrong for Christians to have money, to have wealth, but it is wrong for the acquisition of riches to become your life's goal. We're going to talk about that, and we're also going to talk about how money doesn't buy happiness, depending on how you're looking at it, and many other things. So I thank you for your kind and patient attention this morning.